If you've ever thought your dog might be a bit depressed or that your cat is kind of obsessive-compulsive, Dr. Laurel Breitman is here to tell you that there's a good chance you may be right. She's called her new book, Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. And in it, she makes the case that non-human creatures can not only suffer from mental illness, but that their experiences are not as different from our own as you might imagine. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased it has brought her to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And you write that your experience with Oliver was what got you curious about the subject of animal madness in the first place. Who was Oliver?
Oliver was a gorgeous, at least in the beginning, kind, affectionate creature that I lost my heart to. He was a Bernese Mountain Dog I adopted with my ex-husband.
But he was 4 years old, and you'd heard that there were problems in the past, so weren't you warned?
A little bit. You know, the first sign should have been that we were adopting him from a veterinary clinic as opposed to a family's home, even though he was a family pet. But, you know, I fell in love with him at first sight, and I ignored all signs. I was both naive and hopeful.
And then what happened?
About 6 months in, he spectacularly lost his mind. He developed such debilitating separation anxiety. We couldn't leave him on his own. He did things like hallucinate, and he was diagnosed with a canine compulsive disorder. He had all manner of issues.
There are a lot of dogs that have separation anxiety. You leave the house, and they bark, they scratch at the front door, and then after a while, they give up. Oliver didn't give up.
He did not give up at all. Yeah, he actually clawed through multiple old Victorian wooden doors. He destroyed wooden floors in our house.
And did he
broke windows.
He jumped out of a four-story window?
Yeah, that was the pinnacle, really, of his panic. But he pushed a window air conditioning unit out of the way, clawed through a screen, and, yeah, jumped out of our kitchen.
Didn't you grow up on a farm? Was this the first time you saw any problem with an animal?
It was. You know, now, though, in retrospect, I feel like my path has crossed so many complex animals, and I'm actually grateful to them because I feel like, you know, when you're met with a creature who sort of defies your expectations, that's actually when you're forced to reckon with something you didn't already believe in. So I also have loved many a difficult donkey. My parents have donkeys. But Oliver was my first dog.
Well, we do hear about stressed out cows and chickens because they are – or pigs because they're often – put into very confined spaces. Are we creating that mental illness for them?
I think absolutely.
If we beat a donkey, as people have been known to do in the past, aren't we making them a bit crazy?
Absolutely. You know, particularly for a captive animal, your environment is everything because it's circumscribed and you spend your whole life in it. And definitely mental illness is rampant in our food animals and those raised for fur. Anybody really raised in terrible conditions. But it's not just animals who are abused and mistreated by humans. I came across so many stories of creatures who had never been abused, including my own dog. He had never been mistreated. He was ignored after his previous family had a baby, but, you know, another dog would have been fine.
It's easy to imagine a chimp with depression, but less intuitive to make the jump to parrots, hamsters. Have these disorders been recognized and diagnosed? I mean, this is a crazy parrot?
What does
a crazy parrot do? Not say Polly want a cracker?
Yes, they will also pluck out all of their feathers. And in fact, feather-picking parrots have in some cases been studied to better understand hair pulling in humans, what's known in people as tricholitomania. So really a lot of these disorders are the kind of funhouse mirror versions of really healthy animal activities. So, you know, mood disorders are really the dark side of being just a feeling animal.
Do we assume that these are genetic? When a parrot is pulling out its feathers, because we share genes with parrots, are we pretty much talking about the same kind of gene that hair pullers might have?
You know, it may be related to genetics in some way, but a lot of this stuff, as in us, is cultural. So sometimes animals learn to pluck their hair from watching other animals. I think gorillas are a primary example of that. One gorilla can be a plucker and then come to a new troop and then suddenly more gorillas are going to pluck because they've seen him. That's also been true in humans with tricholitomania. But, you know, that's really just a grooming behavior gone awry, a little bit like a person who will compulsively wash their hands. You know, a mouse, say, can develop a paw-washing compulsion too.
You write about an elephant named Rara.
Yes. Yeah. She's an example of a creature. You know, we often do this to other animals where we kind of make them unfit for both worlds. She was a hotel elephant raised at a Sheraton hotel in southern Thailand as a baby. And this happens at many hotels in Thailand. They're kind of baby elephants are kept there as a sort of photo op. And I think in some ways, sadly, social media has made this worse. But she was raised as a hotel elephant, bonded with people, taken from her mother at a young age. And then when it came to being a fully functioning, emotionally healthy adult elephant, she kind of didn't know where to fit in. She's neither person nor elephant.
Isn't that true with many of the animals that we make into pets? And wouldn't it be true for dolphins, for example, or even whales that are in these shows where we train them to do certain things, and then suddenly we expect them to return to the ocean?
Yes, I'm critical of a lot of those efforts. I certainly don't think that marine mammals should be captive or performing, but I also don't think it's fair to take a creature who's spent their entire life with a human family and then release them and sort of say, "Go back to your family now." You know, they have no culture, and they will be depressed and unfit.
And we've seen that with chimps that were raised with human families, who then lived the rest of their lives in total confusion. They didn't know whether that woman was really their mother or just some strange member of another species.
Yes, you know, I really...
And betrayed them when they returned them to the zoo.
Absolutely, it's unfair. And I think in so many ways, you know, I would love to eradicate a lot of the... Animal captivity industry, but I also think just doing away with it and sending them back to some place they've never lived isn't the answer. We need halfway houses in a lot of cases for these creatures.
Now, we've been talking about mammals and birds, which are often very smart. What about mosquitoes or other lesser animals? Can they also have emotions?
Great question. You know, there's some really interesting research going on about all of this right now. You know, emotions in honeybees or in fruit flies. And you know, what I think is exciting about all of this, and frankly, it makes a lot of sense, things like panic or anxiety are actually really helpful animal emotional experiences when we feel them in dangerous situations, and those are really evolutionarily adaptive. So odds are we are just not the only ones to feel these things.
My guest is Laurel Braitman, Braitman. Her book, Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. We often read human behavior into our pets. Isn't it a form of anthropomorphism?
Yes.
And usually that is dismissed as such. But you say that maybe it's useful to just anthropomorphize well.
Exactly. I actually don't think we can avoid anthropomorphism. You know, you can't take your human brain out of your head and put it in a jar and then use it to think about another animal thinking. We will always be biased by our own animal experience. So I think actually we should just embrace it and try to do it well.
I've always thought that dogs can be jealous, and I just read a report in the newspapers that scientists are saying they show signs of jealousy.
Absolutely.
I don't know whether cats are jealous. They seem to just want to sleep 18 hours a day, but so do dogs. So can we always know whether an animal, a dog or a cat who seems depressed is really depressed or just sleepy?
That's a great question, but I wouldn't know how to answer that in other people, too. You know, so much of this is mysterious. And when you ask another person, even though we're of the same species and we share the same language, how they feel or if they're depressed or not, often they can't put words to that themselves. And so I don't think the not knowing should keep us from empathizing. And in the case of like dogs and cats that you know well, you're the best judge of their behavior. And so I think that's a clear case of anthropomorphizing well if you notice a change in a behavior of a creature you know.
Well, they are bred to have different kinds of qualities, so I'd assume that the illnesses might vary with different breeds.
They absolutely do. Some breeds are famous for becoming more obsessed with shadows, or, you know, Doberman pinschers are famous for developing compulsions to lick themselves. Really all kinds of creatures. Bernese mountain dogs will, like mine, hallucinate and snap at flies that don't exist. This stuff is just far more complex and interesting than I ever thought possible. We do come into the world with our own predetermined susceptibilities sometimes.
But before we even started talking about mental illness in animals, weren't we testing rats and monkeys as stand-ins for humans in psychological studies?
Yes. I mean, that's really why I do think we should embrace anthropomorphism openly, because we've been doing it tacitly since for a very, very long time. Almost everything that we know about the unhinged human mind stems from our observations in other creatures. And when it comes to, say, psychopharmaceuticals, yes, like our entire psychopharmaceutical arsenal we owe to other creatures. And they were tested in them not just for toxicity, but for behavioral effects.
And there are many people who object to doing that to a rhesus monkey or a chimpanzee.
Yeah, for very good reason. You know, a lot of tests now are redundant. We know a lot. I still do think we need animal stand-ins for humans in many situations, but not as much as we use them for. And certainly we can improve their conditions.
How did Darwin's argument shape how scientists understand animal emotion and behavior?
Oh, I love this question. One of the reasons I got into this was because while I was trying to help my own dog, I was reading a ton of Darwin. And, I was going to CVS to fill his, like, liver-flavored Prozac prescription. And I wanted to know how on earth Prozac got into CVS in the first place for dogs. And I was reading all this Darwin, and he was saying so many of these things that seemed revolutionary. Like, he believed other animals could lose their minds, just not as much as people. And so what I became curious about is then what happened in the last 150 years that somehow this feels new again. And I do think some of what he was saying was written off because it was inconvenient. But at the same time, you know, we were using animals as proxies for humans the whole time.
It also went against the conventional wisdom. René Descartes thought that animals were unfeeling automatons.
Yes, but, you know, our thinking about other animal minds has never been progressive. So at the same time that people were writing them off, like here in New York, there was major headlines about animals losing their minds and dying from homesickness and heartbreak. And so the public really was on board with this stuff the entire time.
Well, we are the leading cause of animal unhappiness, it seems to me. But we also, until we started developing automobiles and such, we rode horses, we used oxen to plow our fields. People still do. And we think of them as just being useful for us.
Yes. You know,
camels are still carrying people across the desert.
Yeah, I really would love to go back to a world in some way where our colleagues are non-humans. But I have to say, though, I want to defend humanity just for a second, because I actually don't think we're the leading cause of animal unhappiness all the time. We are also frequently the leading cause of animal happiness. Like, for every one of these cases I came across of, like, an animal who'd been mistreated and wound up as depressed or with OCD or something, PTSD, there were so many people who turned their lives upside down to help the creatures they cared for.
Is obsessive compulsive disorder common in cats or in animals in general?
Yes, yes, very, very common. In fact, if you want to do anything interesting and you're online, like, just go to YouTube and Google OCD dog or cat and just see the just thousands of films that come up.
Dr. Carol Wilburn called in with a comment. She's a cat therapist, and she says that cats and other pets sometimes mirror their human companions' emotional problems.
Yes, yes. I actually have a good friend. He has a service dog that he's a veteran, and he was given a service dog for his PTSD and fear of heights. And a few months into their relationship, his dog actually developed a fear of heights, his service dog. But he still works as a fantastic service dog, because my friend is now so concerned with his dog's well-being that he forgets to be scared himself.
Do dogs who've been through traumatic experiences develop PTSD on their own?
Yeah. In fact, a lot of canine veterans of conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan are coming back now with post-traumatic stress disorder, doing things like refusing to approach cars at checkpoints or men in uniform, things like this.
How far does this go? Do we also see bipolar animals or psychotic animals? Well, your dog, to some degree, sounds almost psychotic.
He was definitely self-destructive and he panicked.
Do you think
he was
trying to kill himself?
No, you know, but that said, I do think we should extend at least to some animals the capability for suicide. You know, we all self-harm. We're all kind of on and by we, I mean much of the animal kingdom, we're on a continuum of self-harm. And I think no one does it quite like humans, with the forethought, pre-planning, use of tools. But certainly some creatures, including some people, might just kill themselves in a rash act because they feel terrible without thinking it through.
And we don't know whether beached whales have committed suicide or whether some other circumstances have led them to that situation.
Yeah, absolutely. But we do know that many whales and dolphins have a sense of self, are self-aware, and probably realize that what they're doing may lead to their death.
In treating all of this, the big problem, it seems to me, is that we can't ask a cat or a dog or a whale, how are you feeling today?
Exactly. But, you know, it's a pretty...
We can't have any talk therapy with them.
No, but it's a pretty new phenomenon that we think that we need to talk to people in order to help them, too. You know, before the early 20th century, physicians mostly diagnosed emotional distress in people by observation alone. We can learn a lot just by being quiet and observant and spending time with somebody.
You have to know an animal's history in many cases, don't you?
Yes.
To understand what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, even to notice that something's abnormal, frankly, usually you need a normal. So that's why most of the cases in the book are about... captive or domestic creatures, but I was able to find a number of cases of wildlife who were surprising people by acting strangely.
Has what you've learned helped you understand mental illness in humans better?
It's made me just vastly more empathetic, I have to say. I'm also so much more grateful to the animals that surround me and those that we use as test subjects.
What were some cases of animals in the wild with mental illness?
Well, one case I talk about in the book a lot are California sea lions who are doing really odd and self-destructive things, like suddenly getting really aggressive and interrupting surfing competitions. One case, the sea lion got on top of a cop car in the San Francisco Bay and just stayed. And autopsies show that they have significant brain damage that might be related to some of these bizarre self-destructive or over-aggressive behaviors. And that's an incidence of, I believe, an environmentally caused epidemic of mental illness in animals.
What we're dumping into the oceans?
Well, this is actually stems from red tide. It's a neurotoxin in the fish that they're eating, but that's probably related to climate change.
So... we're looking at animals and how their mental illness manifests itself, and then thinking about how it relates to humans. In the end, what is the final? Well, first of all, how do we treat the animals? Is there any kind of therapy that human-like therapy that we can apply to them?
Yes, and in fact, this is something that I wish human medicine would take from veterinary medicine in a lot of ways, which is when you say bring a dog who's compulsively chasing his tail to the vet, their first move isn't to reach for the prescription pad, it's to ask you about the dog's life. They want to know how much exercise the dog gets, how much time with other dogs and people, and then what they do is usually give you a prescription and behavior therapy to do with the dog, or telling them to get more exercise. And, you know, animals, we tend to think of them as products of their environment more than we think about that with humans suffering from mental illness, and I think that's a mistake.
You invite people to reach you at animalmadness.com. The book is called Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being on our show, Laurel Braitman.
Thank you so much for having me.